Okay, so this is day two of the Kerr Method's Modular and Symmetry. And let's just recap briefly what we did yesterday. Yesterday we talked about things we know and things that we vaguely know or that we have heard about, and we tried to find some common ground where we can start. So we talked about words a lot and what they mean. And then we defined what a group is, and we looked for examples and counterexamples, and we started working with this concept in terms of what are the calculations that we can do? What are the things that follow immediately from the axioms? For example, in the group axioms, we ask for an element that behaves neutrally with a binary operation, and we were able to show that there is a unique element that does that. And it doesn't matter which way around we combine the elements for the neutral element. Okay. And then we also found that for each group element, we find a so-called inverse. And again, we were able to prove that the ordering doesn't matter and that there is a unique inverse for every group element. Then we proved a cancellation rule, actually two cancellation rules. We are going to talk about why we need to, or whether we need to later. We looked at substructures, and we found some motivation why substructures might be interesting. In particular, we talked about permutation groups for quite a time, and I tried to motivate with lots of pictures and examples why it might be interesting to study permutation groups in more detail and to look for substructures in such a way that we can use constraints for symmetry, which means that if we have a structure and we could potentially look at all permutations of all the points or maybe all the edges or whatever it is that we can permute, by constraining the symmetry, we might end up with a much smaller structure. And today we're going to talk about this in more detail. How can we find these substructures? How can we classify symmetry? How can we work with it? I worked on my material and I made some adjustments based on our discussion yesterday, but I was not able to include examples that might be really exactly what you need for your research, just because it would take much longer than one evening or one morning. But I hope that I can maybe give you enough ideas so that you can then extend what we did for your own context, with your background, with your setting. That would be the idea. This is where we ended up. So let's just recall where we were. The name of the chapter is Symmetry Groups, and my motivation was that full permutation groups correspond to perfect symmetry. There are no constraints, there are no restrictions. And breaking the symmetry in some way, for example, adding colors or adding more structure, means that we can reduce the number of permutations. So we make the group smaller and easier to handle, and it gives us ideas for classification. And then at some point, it occurred to me that maybe, just like the word continuous map created some confusion, maybe when I say symmetry, it's also not completely clear what I mean, because I think that yesterday, when I said permutation, it was not clear to everyone what it is. And therefore I thought maybe I should just write down what symmetry means to me now, because I'm not using symmetry for a vague concept, I'm using symmetry as a word for a specific map. A symmetry is a map from an object to itself, a set of points to itself, and there are only two things we need to consider. The symmetry needs to be bijective, and it needs to be distance preserving. So this is what we do now. And depending on context, symmetry can mean something else. It has to be bijective, but you can replace distance preserving by something else, depending on the structure that you have. Maybe there is a better word or a better concept than distance preserving. But this is what we do now, because all my pictures will be in R squared, and then the Euclidean distance is the intuitive thing that we're going to refer to. Maybe you have heard the term isometry. That's related. So isometries very often are, so the word isometry is often used for distance preserving map, and then it depends on the context and on the mathematical rigor whether you also define what your distance is or whether you have an intuitive concept for that. Right, so just for clarification, asymmetry, and it doesn't matter whether we say function or map in this context, and all the examples, or most of the examples, will be R2 to R2 with Euclidean distance
and we can check this against our intuition later on in the examples. This is the setup, and the hypothesis that we're going to work with later is the following. I call it hypothesis S like symmetry, and we're going to use the following notation. We have a natural number n, and n is at least 3. We want to talk about triangles at least. Everything below that is boring. And then we have the set of vertices of a regular n1. So with a regular n1, I mean an n1 where all the angles inside have the same size. So everything, all the distances, all the angles are the same. And I only use script P for the set of vertices because when I think about symmetries of the n1, then I only think about how I move the vertices. And then I just suppose that the edges are moved along in the corresponding way. So if I wanted to define this really, really correctly, then I would have to define the point set I'm talking about first, and I would have to think about whether I want to take the whole boundary or maybe everything, including the space in the middle. But for now, just because this is good for our notation later, let's just think of the vertices, and everything else should just move along. So by symmetry of a regular n1, I mean a bijective map of all the set of all these points to itself, distance preserving. But when we write them down, we only think about the points, which is why I have the notation for the vertices. And they are numbered counterclockwise, like yesterday in the examples, 1 to n. The full symmetry group, which is the group of all symmetries, will be denoted by S like symmetry. And let us briefly discuss and repeat the concept of a group, why this is a group and how. Because we don't just need a set, we also need a binary operation. So what is the binary operation for the set of symmetries of a regular n1? It's maps. What would be the most natural binary operation that we can think of after yesterday?
Composition.
Say it again?
Composition.
Composition, exactly. So I was not asking for examples of maps, I was asking for the binary operation. And this should be composition of maps. And now let's discuss briefly why the four axioms hold. Okay? So we have a regular n1. We have a bijective map from this n1 to itself, and it should be distance preserving as well. We have the set of all these maps, including the identity map, which is important. We have that there. And now let's go through the axioms. So binary operation, okay, we take composition. If I have two maps that are bijective and I compose them, then what I get is again a bijective map. We have used that yesterday. If I combine two distance-preserving maps with the same distance function, then again I get a distance-preserving map. So that's fine, which means that we are really closed under the binary operation. That's G1. G2, associativity, maps, we don't even think about it. G3, neutral element, the identity map. G4. What about G4? Now I have a symmetry, which means I have a bijective map that is distance preserving. How can I find something that behaves like an inverse? So if I compose the two, I get the identity map. How can I do that? The thing is that we don't know what the symmetry does. So you can think of examples, but please do not assume that you know all the symmetries, because maybe you don't. You have to work with the abstract notion of what a symmetry is.
Isn't the fact that it's a bijective map tell us that there exists an inverse for every...
Absolutely, yes, there exists an inverse, that's true. But we have a second condition, distance preservation. Will the inverse map also preserve distances? That's the interesting question. Of course, you're right. Your intuition goes exactly in the right direction. So what do we think? Will the inverse also respect distances?
Intuitively, it should.
Yeah, because the identity does.
Yeah.
So you can do these calculations and just basically
So how do you do it? Take a little note here somewhere.
So let's say we have alpha, and we know that the distance, the distance from, let's say, the point I to the point J is the same as the distance from the image of A under alpha, so alpha is symmetry, to J under alpha. Now, if we apply alpha inverse, then we can apply it here, but then here we get the identity, because alpha composed with alpha inverse is the identity map, and then we get the same, just like minus alpha, with inverse. That the inverse map also preserves the same distance function, and that means, yay, we have a group. So from now on, we will have this group S and the composition of maps, and we can work with it, and we know it's a group, so everything we proved is fine. Yes?
We need to show that every regular endon that we can think of is also an image of our alpha map. Because we showed this now for all images of alpha, that alpha to the minus one preserves.
I was thinking about vertices now, like at pointer, and I'm just talking about one regular endon where everything happens. So yes, these images would of course be vertices of the same endon. I don't have different ones.
Yes, but after the permutation, or
it's projective. I'm not understanding your question, maybe. Try again.
So the idea is that that alpha, you have the composition, which is the identity. So mm-hmm. you know that the identity preserves distances.
Mm-hmm.
And now alpha maps the endon to another endon.
No, to the same endon, that's the point. It's a bijective map from this endon to itself. So every point is an image under alpha, and also under alpha inverse. They are bijective maps, so they are also surjective. Every point is an image. That hopefully answers the question.
Yeah.
That's the idea. Yeah, so it's always the same endon. So I'm not thinking about there's one endon here and there's another endon here. No, it's the same thing, and I'm really just thinking about swapping things around, so everything we know, like rotations and reflections, all these things will be symmetries. The question is whether there's anything more, anything we don't know about. Yeah, it's always the same endon. Yes, I should have made this more clear. Thank you for asking.
Okay, now that we have already started repeating things, let's get a bit more active together and look at the first few exercises. So let's look at exercise number one with all these little parts, A to I, and let's discuss in each case whether we have a group or not, just to get warmed up and in order to split the discussion of the exercises a little bit throughout the day. That's the plan, at least. And I prepared something for notes. So I invite you to share what you thought about these exercises, and if necessary, I will take some notes or maybe give some further explanations, but if everything is clear to everyone, then we can always just keep it brief. Let's begin by, or let's begin with, Z with minus. The integers and the binary operation is minus. Do we get a group? Yes? Okay, explain everything to me.
So we go step by step, like the 1 to 4, so whatever operation you do with integer, you will always get an integer, so first.
That's true. If I subtract an integer from an integer, I get an integer. Yes.
Yeah. So it's first condition is satisfied.
Mm-hmm.
The second is associative, which will also hold when you are minus, like if you.
Did you check it?
Associative is not satisfied.
That's exactly it. It's one of the very few examples where associativity does not hold. It's not a group.
Okay.
So it looks like one, but it's not a group. So if you didn't try to check it, then this is why you were not able to find the mistake. So this is one of the reasons. And I've done this. My linear algebra class, my professor, he was one of the few, I think, who gave exercises of this kind. So he asked true or false, or does it work or does it not? And I learned so much because I made so many stupid mistakes. It's good to make these stupid mistakes. It's good to be kind of naive and think, oh, this looks right, I'm sure it's right, because often it's not, and then you learn a lot from that. So, welcome to the club. I learned in exactly the same way in my linear algebra course that some of the things that to me looked completely convincing and true are just not. Z minus is not a group. The other stuff works. We have zero, which behaves like a neutral element, and we have inverses, but since associativity is not holding, we don't have a group. Did someone have an example? Can we write down a specific example with numbers where it doesn't work? Because there are people who saw it.
Any ABC,
you can just write
ABC.
You can take anything. So I prefer to have precise examples, because if you do it just with letters, then maybe there might be special cases where it's still true. We need a precise example for it to be able to show that it really is not true. So let's take one. Make a suggestion.
1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3.
So we take 1 minus 2 with these brackets, -3, and we start working. So 1 minus 2 is -1, -3 is -4. And now we change the brackets. So now it's 1 minus and then 2 minus 3. I hope that's correct the way I did it. Oh, it's very small. Sorry, you have to tell me if it's too small. So now first I do 2 minus 3, which is -1, and then I have 1 minus -1, which is 2. So it's not the same. Okay, so z minus is not a group. What about z with multiplication? What do you think? Shaking your head. No, it's not. Why not?
Because the inverse doesn't exist in the integer.
Again, we need a specific example. Give me a number that doesn't have an inverse.
The identity element would be 1, so if I take 2, then it's inverse.
Yes, exactly. So we have a template for an identity element. So this would be 1a, this is b. So the identity element would be 1. And then 1 has an inverse, and -1 also has an inverse, but that's all. So 2 doesn't have an inverse. Right. This is how we can motivate to make domains of numbers bigger. So we can motivate by saying, oh, actually there is a calculation here that I would like to do, and I cannot. And therefore I extend the domain, and I create more numbers, and this is how you can or how maybe you want to construct rationals from the integers. And then there's still zero, which doesn't have an inverse, but that's a problem for another day. Okay, let's move on. So this was B. Now, C. C was the set of 2x2 matrices over the reals with matrix addition. What do you think? Does it work? Is it a group? I see some people nodding. Okay. We don't have to talk about G1, I believe. Do we have to talk about G2? Associativity? We learned that it's worth checking, right? Did you check? Yeah, and it all boils down to associativity of the addition and the reals, right? Now, it gets more interesting. Neutral element and inverses. What did you find?
The zero matrix.
The zero matrix, yes, that's right. That's the neutral element. And what about inverses? How do we get them?
Just
the negative of the entries, yes. So everything seems to boil down to the rules that we have for addition in the reals, and I think I mentioned yesterday that this is what happens a lot. You have a domain where you already have one binary operation so that you can create a group, and then often you can combine this, you can create tuples or matrices or other things and find new groups in that way. We have to be a little bit careful there, as we will see later, but yeah. Right, now 2x2 matrices over the reals with matrix multiplication. How about that? It's closed under matrix multiplication. Okay, that's fine. Associativity? Oh, we should be careful. It's matrix multiplication. It's weird.
Yeah, but
that could have been the problem, I think, but since it's all 2 cross 2 matrices, the multiplication is defined, and we will also get 2 cross 2 multiplication, I mean matrices.
Yeah. It's really annoying to check that. I do this in my linear algebra course, and it's always one of these moments where I regret doing it. But you have to do it, right? Because we saw it can go wrong. So I'm standing there, and I'm doing it, and I'm always thinking, oh, you should never do matrix multiplication in public, but there we go. Yeah, it actually holds. And there is a philosophical reason maybe why it holds, because depending on the matrix entries, depending on the general context, there is an interpretation of these matrices as linear maps. And for maps, we have the law of associativity. So it's not surprising that it also holds for matrices if you have this bigger context. Right, but we have more. We need a neutral element, and we need inverses. So there we go. Do we have candidates for a neutral element? The identity matrix, yes. And now we need inverses. How do we get those? Inverse matrices.
Yeah, it may not exist. So.
It may not exist. Do you have an example for me?
Zero matrix.
I mean, there's a determinant that can go to zero.
The zero matrix does not have an inverse,
yeah.
For example. And there are plenty of others. I'm sure you know this from your linear algebra background, right? Yeah. So we can look at the rank. And matrices of rank 2 will be invertible. They will have inverses for matrix multiplications, but if the rank is 0 or 1, then we don't find anything, and therefore, unfortunately, things go wrong again. Does not have an inverse. Okay. E, the rationalness with multiplication. That's looking good. So tell me, group, yes or no? We think it's a group. Okay, let's start. Binary operation is multiplication. Are the rationals closed under multiplication? They are. Oh, it's interesting because now you all have the suspicious look on your face because you think if it went wrong with Z and minus, then there must be something else. And she's smiling at us, but huh, no, there must be something. This is good. This is the right mindset. Yeah, better be a little bit too careful and a little bit suspicious, in particular when it looks really easy and intuitive. Associativity, the rationals and multiplication, okay, that's fine, no danger there. Do you see a candidate for a neutral element?
One.
One, the number one. Okay, so again, inverses, and let's be careful and check. Is everything okay with inverses? Do we run? No, why not?
Zeros, like one of zeros.
Ah.
Okay, same problem as before. No inverse for zero, but maybe we can repair this. What if I take zero out and take multiplication? Because zero is the only problem, right? All the others do have an inverse. So maybe I can repair this by just saying goodbye to zero. We don't need you here. We want to multiply things. Associativity is still fine, and our neutral element 1 is still around. So what is the only thing we need to check now? For this maybe to be a group. What do we need to check? What has changed? This is advanced. This is a little bit advanced. Think about it. So now we have repaired G4. G3 is still fine. G2 is still fine. What about G1? Because the set has changed. We need to check for the binary operation again. So what is it that we need to check? And I'm sure this is a rule that you know and that you use every day.
Could you also always get a rational?
You started first.
Yeah, we won't get a zero unless we are multiplying by zero. And since zero is not there, we won't get it as well. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now I want to listen to the others, yes?
Same?
Yeah, I was just going to say, you always get a rational number anyway.
Yeah.
You get a rational number, but the thing is, you need to get a rational number that is not zero. And
yeah, but if you multiply that to non-zero rational numbers, you
exactly. With matrices, this is not true. You can multiply two non-zero matrices and get the zero matrix, and therefore we have to be careful. What we see here is everyday maths,
But really, it's not everyday math, because math is more weird than that. Therefore, I'm asking you to be careful, but yes, in the rationals, if we multiply two numbers that are non-zero, then we get not zero again. And this is something that, this is a property that fields have. So we talked about fields, and I think I got the question what a field is, and I postponed it. So now is the perfect moment to explain it. The rational numbers are a field, and this means that you have two binary operations, let's call them plus and dot, or times, addition and multiplication, such that the following holds. If you take the first binary operation, then you get a group, so this is q and plus, that's a group. If you take the neutral element for the first binary operation, which was would be zero, and you throw it out, like we did here, and you take the second binary operation, then you get a group again. And it has to be commutative. Both these groups have to be commutative, which they are. And then you need one more condition that kind of combines the two binary operations. And you know these as distributive law, the combination of plus and times. If you have all that, then you have a field, a so-called field. In this case, the field of rational numbers that, as I said, can be constructed from the integers. And in fact, there's an algebraic structure that is a little bit weaker than being a field, but it's a bit stronger, or maybe a bit more diverse, a bit more interesting maybe than just being a group, depending on your point of view. And that would be rings. Maybe you have seen rings as well. So the integers, for example, they are a ring. You have a group with plus, that's commutative, and you have an interesting structure with multiplication, that's not a group, but there is something interesting going on, and you have, again, a link between the two with the distributive laws. As I said, so this is not a course on algebraic structures, but if you are interested, this would be something that could be extended. And there we would run into a Q again, because fields are special cases of rings. As rings, they're not very interesting, but fields have other interesting properties for themselves, and you can study fields and field extensions, and then you go into Galois theory, and it's all very fascinating. Let's move on. F. Set of maps from the reals to themselves with composition. What do you think? Is it looking good? Is it a group? I see some people nodding. Let's check. Is the set of these maps closed under the binary operation that we have, namely composition? Yeah, okay. If I combine two such maps, then again I get a map from the reals to themselves. Associative law is fine. We have this from maps. Now, what we need a neutral element. Do you have a candidate for this example? What could it be? The identity map, again, yeah? Very often with maps, the identity map. So if it's around, then it's a candidate. And then we need inverses. So we need G4. How do we find inverses? What do you think?
I don't know how to find inverses.
You don't know how to find inverses? Neither do I. Because if we take any map, it might not have an inverse. Let's take the map from the reals to the reals that maps everything to 1. That's a map. It's in our set. It doesn't have an inverse. How should it? I mean, what do you do? If everything gets mapped to 1, there is no way of turning back. This is too weak. You don't get a group this way. You get something slightly weaker. Okay, so again, it's not working. What about continuous maps with compositions? So maybe the problem is solved now. Being continuous is working with composition. So if you combine two continuous maps from the reals to themselves, again, you get a continuous map, so that's fine. What about the other stuff? Do we still have our neutral element? The identity map, is it continuous? Yes. Inverses. Now, we had a problem before. Is the problem gone? You have been quiet. What do you think?
No, it's not gone.
Why?
The example that you just gave is a continuous map.
Okay. Problem's not solved. How could we solve the problem? I'm sure that you know a property of maps that would immediately solve this problem.
Which one is that?
It should not just do one, like you said, everything mapping to one, that's not, that is not, that would not have an inverse, but if every input you take has only one output, I didn't get it.
That's the definition of a map of a function, that everything I take only has one well-defined output. No, it's not that. But it's interesting that now we make the same mistake that all my beginners always make. That's great. Yeah, it's how we learn about maps. So for something to be a map, we need exactly what you just said. So it's important to talk about this. So let's say again, maybe not alpha, let's call it beta this time, from the reals to the reals. What you just said is that if I take x from the reals and if I map it, then it has to be defined to be just one element. I have no choice. It can't have several images, but only one. That's what you said. But this is what it means to be a map. Otherwise, you would have lots of arrows in different directions and you wouldn't know which one to pick. And actually, if you do deeper mathematics, for example, if you talk about factor structure sections, we discussed it yesterday briefly, then you need to worry about this, because then sometimes you have something that looks like a map, but maybe it's not, because maybe you have a choice for different images, and then you need to see how you can fix the situation. This probably never happens in your work, I don't know. But what is it that you mean? It's not that you only have one image.
X beta is never equal to y beta for x.
So this is what you mean. You mean if x is not equal to y, then x beta is not equal to y beta.
Yeah.
What is that property?
So you can always go back.
So we can go back. There is a unique error. Well, not yet. Not yet. This property says that if I see two images, then there is a unique error going back to their three images, and you can't choose.
Yeah.
But how do I know that there is an error going back? Maybe there is a real number that is not something that goes back.
Right.
So I need another one.
But aren't we dealing with a set of maps? So there has to be one map somewhere which is taking this number and mapping it somewhere.
No, we don't know that.
Okay.
I mean, the thing is that for any given map, we don't know which real numbers are images or not.
Right.
But if our goal is to find an inverse map, then somehow we need that. So if we want to find an inverse, then we need the property that we just discussed.
We definitely need that, just one arrow going back. But the thing is, if there is no arrow, then again, I have no way of finding the inverse function. It's interesting. I'm wondering whether you maybe have never learned these words separately. There is a word for that property, and I was sure that you know it.
Injective.
Right. So what's the other word that we need?
Surjective.
Surjective. Together they give bijective. Maybe this is something that you have learned once and forgotten, because now you only need bijective and maybe you never need the property separately. The thing is that a map from the reals to the reals can be injective but not surjective. So this is something about infinite sets. As I said, infinite sets are weird. So if you have a finite set and you have an injective map from the set into itself, then it needs to be surjective automatically. But for infinite sets, this is not true, which is why we need both. So this is injectivity. This means that if there is an arrow back, then there is only one arrow back, so to speak, and this is something that is necessary to find an inverse function. But it's not enough, because if there is no arrow, then we have no way to find an inverse function, which means that we also need surjective, and surjective is if z is an R, then there exists an x such that z is x to the beta. So there exists a so-called pre-image, a guy that is mapped to z. So this is surjective. And we need both. So we need bijective maps in order to be able to find an inverse, which means that being continuous does not save us, but being bijective does.
Is it possible to make a group of injective maps if we consider the initial domain being not the whole real numbers, but subsets, arbitrary subsets of the real numbers?
We would still need that if you... we would. In that case, you cannot have an inverse map for the whole domain, but you would have to define it only on the image. So you would need several manipulations if you wanted to do that. But yes, I guess it depends on what exactly you want to model, whether this is possible. But basically, so what we often do is that we restrict maps in order to fix problems. If a map is not injective, for example, because like squaring, it doesn't see a sign, so it's not injective, but you can repair this by just restricting the domain you start with to one of the possibilities. And if a map is not surjective, then you can also fix this by just making the target domain smaller, so you only have the image. But then depending on what you want to do with your maps, manipulating the starting area or the finishing area, the goal area, might create problems, because now maybe it's not possible to compose maps anymore. And then this is another reason why you can't get a group, because now suddenly it doesn't match and you cannot compose the maps any way around, which is similar to multiplying matrices that are not square matrices, because then maybe one way around it works but the other way around it doesn't, and you could run into a similar problem there. So yeah, it gets more complicated than that. Let's move on. So we have H. The set of maps from the reals to themselves with addition. Did you know what I mean by that? Did you have... you didn't. Okay, so I will tell you what I mean, and then you can think about this in the lunch break when we have more time to think about exercises. Good, let's see. I meant... so this is H. I meant the following. Let's take two maps, alpha and beta, from the reals to themselves. And I want to define what alpha plus beta does. So I just have to say what this map does. How do I define what a map does? I have to say where it starts and where it ends. Okay, reals, reals. And now I have to say what it does to the real numbers. So I define for all x in the reals, x mapped by alpha plus beta is defined to be x mapped by alpha plus x mapped by beta. So very simple, very intuitive. I add maps by taking images separately and then adding the images. And the question is whether we get a group.
So this is the set of alphas and betas.
Yes, it's the set of maps, it's the set of alphas and betas, and I have to tell you what the binary operation does. And I'm telling you this by telling you what the map alpha plus beta does. So this is what I meant by this exercise. I is a set of permutations with composition. I'm not even sure we need to discuss this because we have very generally spoken about permutations of Z, so this is probably okay. Do you have pictures for permutations of Z? Did you have ideas what such a permutation could be?
Replace the positive numbers by any set of integers, maybe? Like yesterday we had examples of 1, 2, 3, 4, whatever. But we can replace the numbers with anything.
Can you give me a rule how you map the numbers? So if I take an integer, where does it get mapped? As an example for a permutation. We need a rule what we should do.
Same as the triangle or square
yesterday.
Mm-hmm. Can you make it more precise? So how do I know where my integer gets mapped?
So in case of the triangle yesterday, 1, 2, 3, it was getting mapped to 5.
And so all the other integers stay the same. So you only interchange those and all the others stay the same. Yeah, that's okay. Of course you can do that. And you have so many possibilities to do just that. So you just take a few, you mix them up, and you leave the rest. Okay, that's fine. Do you have other ideas where maybe everything is moved or almost everything is moved? Other ideas for permutations of the integers?
Convert the negative to the positive?
Yeah, we could swap, like having a mirror at zero, and then we change the sign. Yeah, that's another interesting one. Something else, maybe? We need other maps later. We need maps with a different quality later, so I want to get your brain going in that direction. What else can we do?
Add some number to every integer?
Like a translation. Yeah, whatever we do, plus, minus, a fixed number, so many possibilities. You see how big this group is? Okay. Okay. That's all? Any questions except for the one that we had for part H? Then we can pick this up later. So throughout the day, we will have these little interruptions where I will ask you about the exercises, just so I get you activated and that we cover everything. And at the end of the day, I want to make sure that you take as much as possible out of these exercises for yourself. Okay? Let me take the opportunity and point to a few typos. Thanks to everyone who told me typos. So there was one that I noticed myself at the very end, where I have A, B, and B, and it should be A, B, and C, but maybe this is not so important. Then we have in exercise number 4, we have a typo because the set where we do the permutations is M, but the group of permutations is called G. And then in the second line, when I take this set M index A, it should be G index A, and it's a subset of G, because here I talk about permutations and not about the elements of the set. So let me write this down as a correction, and I will correct the PDF and make sure that you get the corrected one along with anything else that maybe you might need after this, after today. So this would be 4, and I mean fix an element A in M. This is correct. So for example, if M is the set of numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, then maybe I want to fix the number 2. And then it's GA, and it's a subset of G. And GA denotes the set of permutations that fix the element A. So I can write down the definition to make it even more clear. GA is the set of maps, let's say alpha. Alpha is a permutation of M, so it's an element of G, such that the number A, or the element A, is fixed. Set of permutations, permutations that fix A. And I'm asking you to prove that this is a group. So again, this should be GA, not MA. This is a weird mistake. Maybe I changed the notation at some point. Anyway, so you are supposed to prove that GA is a group, and I suggest by using to do this by using that you have the big group G. So maybe you don't need to check all the axioms, but maybe there is something in the course that will help you do this work. Okay, so that was one bit, and then there was another typo. But that's just reference typos. So in lemma, it says in lemma 2.1, do we really need that the points are next to each other? And this doesn't make sense because in the current lemma 2.1, there is no such situation, but there is it is in 3.1. So this is because I changed the numbering of the chapters and I did not update it in the exercise sheet. So in exercise 6, it should be 3.1. And this is what we're going to do next, so you will see what I mean. Okay, okay, with moving on from the exercises and continuing with the content.
Okay, let's change this here. There we go. And we are going to talk about lemma 3.1 next. But first I want to introduce some more notation. So we already have a regular N1, we have the vertices, we have the symmetry group. We discussed why this is a group. We repeated some more stuff. And now I would like to introduce some more notation just to make our life easier now when we talk about specific maps. For example, we have reflections in our regular N1, and I wanted to have notation for reflections. Sometimes it makes our life easier if we can just give a map a specific name and we all know what we talk about. And sometimes when you have a reflection in your regular N1, then it fixes a point. It could be that the point, that some point lies on the reflection line, and then it's fixed. And in that case, I want to use this point to denote the reflection, because if I fix a point, then there is a unique reflection line that goes through this point, and therefore my reflection is uniquely determined. So I can use this point to describe the reflection. If there is no such point, which can also happen, then I don't have this name, then I just need to find another name. But so we have this possibility for notation. And yes.
Repeat what you just said, that if you fix a point, and there's only a
mm-hmm. I can also, I prepared some stuff. And to, yeah, I can show it now. I wanted to show this later, but I can show it now because it helps to answer your question, I think. This would be, so for those who listen to the audio, this is where I show a picture of a regular 6-1, and I drew a reflection line such that the reflection corresponding to it does not fix any points, because here 1 and 6 are interchanged, 2 and 5 are interchanged, 3 and 4 are interchanged. No, I mean there are points that are fixed, but not vertices around at the corners, and this is what I mean. We can write this, actually let's do this now. Messing up my plan, that's fine. Let's do this now. Let's write this as a permutation of the points 1 to 6, the way we learned yesterday. Maybe you remember how we do that. So we have to tell where the point 1 is mapped. Let's start with 1. So bracket starts. Where's 1 mapped? 1, 6. And now, where's 6 going? Back to 1, so I can close the bracket. Now, I don't stop because there is more happening in this map, which means I open another bracket, and now I can do whatever I want, but let's just say I did 1, and the next small number that I have not yet looked at is 2. So where is 2 going?
2,
5. 2 is going to 5. And where is 5 going?
2.
Back to 2, so I close the bracket. If 3 and 4 are not mapped anywhere, if they stay, then I can stop, but they are moved, so I should better go on with 3. Where does 3 go? 4, and 4 goes back to 3, so this is my map, written as a permutation. Right? So we're going to need this later. Therefore, it's good to do this now. And now let's use a different color for another reflection, because you asked about reflections that fix a point, and by point I always mean these corners. For example, this one here, it even has 2 fixed points, namely 1 and 4, and I could name it reflection 1, because the line goes through 1. And then depending on the size of the N1, I know that there is, maybe I know that there is another point opposite that is also fixed, or maybe not, because it could be that this reflection line goes through the middle between 2 points, if the number of points is odd.
So we don't have a unique line which is going through 1.
Oh, we do. In a fixed N1, it's unique.
You said that we could also have a line that is going through.
In a different N1.
In a different N1.
Yeah, but not in the same one. So I use all this notation always in reference to a fixed setting with a fixed N1, and then everything I said is unique. So if N is 6, then there is a unique reflection with reflection line going through 1. And this is the name of it. If N is different, then again, there is a unique reflection going through 1, but it will be a different map because it's a different N1 and different things happen.
Right.
Yeah, so it's uniqueness referring, but within a set context. And let's just always make clear that we know what the context is, and then it's fine. And this is why the notation makes sense. And for this other type of reflection, where we have no fixed point, we cannot use this, then we just need to come up with another name. Yeah. Is that better now? Is it? Okay, good. Thank you for asking.
So these reflections also have to be distance preserving?
Oh yeah, because I mean, now we are just using our intuitive notion of reflections, and they are distance preserving by their nature, which is why they are symmetries. So they show up in our symmetry groups, just like rotations. If I do rotations around the middle, they're distance preserving, so they also show up in our symmetry groups, which means that we already know quite a few guys in our symmetry groups, and the question is, do we know them all? Because maybe there is something weird going on some symmetry that we don't see in this intuitive way, but that they're still bijective and distance preserving. Could be, right? In theory. Now, let's pretend we have no idea.
And in this case, reflection 1 would be the same as reflection 4.
Exactly, yes. Reflection 1 would be the same as reflection 4. Yeah. So they come in pairs because n is even. So there is a different behavior. There is an exercise about that, so I won't go into all the details, but there is different behavior when it comes to reflections depending on whether n is even or odd. Yeah.
So
good. Yeah.
With distance preserving, you have set something more in mind, not just distance preserving, right? Because we could.
Why?
Any rotation is distance preserving, but we cannot. We want to exclude like arbitrary rotations. The exact one. It should be that all the points are aligned to their position. They're fixed to their positions. So that we do not have to think about the coordinates rotating of the hexagon.
Yes, I don't think about it in that way because I only think about the set of points, and the set of points is mapped to itself. And as soon as I, for example, fix this point here, then the distance preservation forces things in the neighborhood of it to happen in a particular way. So it really is only distance preservation, but it. But lots of things that we intuitively think are true for symmetries follow from that. It is really just distance preservation, I think. I don't see what else I would assume here. I only say we only look at rotations where the center is the center of the n-gon, things like that, because the set of points shouldn't be moved away. But I don't think I mean anything more than distance preservation. What do you have in mind? Maybe I'm not understanding the question.
Yeah. If we consider a lattice, what we discussed briefly yesterday, then we have translations, for example.
Oh yeah, but I'm not allowed to move the set of points away, so translations are out of the picture. Right? So it's in the definition. I have a set of points and I have a bijective map from this set of points to itself. And then I can move points around within the set, and I only have to consider distance preservation. But this is why translations are out of the picture. They will come back later, but not here. At the moment, we are only mapping this picture to itself. And therefore, distance preservation is enough.
Okay.
Right? But it will come back later, I promise, because this is what I prepared after our discussion yesterday. I wanted to get translations back in the picture. Are there more questions about the notation before we move on? Let's check what else I wrote. We have rotations around the center, blah, blah, blah. And yesterday we already learned how we can classify them because we just take the number of vertices and then we divide by this number. We divide 360 degrees by that, which gives us the kind of basis angle for our kind of smallest rotation that is not the identity, which in our case, for example, here would be 60 degrees. So the rotation would move always counterclockwise, so the rotation would move 1 to 2, 2 to 3, and so on. And again, we can use permutation group language and write this rotation, and it has a name. The rotation in this case would be rod 1, and it moves 1 to 2, 2 to 3, 3 to 4, 4 to 5, 5 to 6, and 6 to 1, which means I get such a zig cycle as our basis rotation, and then all the other rotations can be written as multiples of this with itself several times. So we get everything. And this means, now I'm speaking to people who know what these words mean, we get a cyclic group of order 6 as a subgroup of the whole symmetry group of our regular sixgon. And it's generated by this basis rotation that I just wrote down. This is not the only possibility for a generator. There is another possibility. But careful, there are some rotations that do not generate all of them, but only a subgroup again. And this is now entering group theory territory, and I should step back before I, you know, start preaching. Let's prove something. Lemma 3.1 gives us a tool to classify symmetries. And I will say why in a moment. I don't know whether you have noticed, but some of these results, they have a technical side, so we can understand the notation and read them, but I usually try to give you some philosophical background. Like, what do they mean? What does this tool do for us? And same here. So we have our hypothesis and our notation. We have two symmetries. I call them sigma and tau. I like these letters. And now I take a point, I, from 1 to n minus 1. So in our example here, with our regular sixgon, it would be one of the points 1 to 5. And there is a reason why I'm not choosing the point 6. So one of these. And then I say, if sigma and tau map this point in the same way, and also its neighbor, so if I count one further, which explains why I stopped at 5, because here I can count one further. If I had chosen 6, then I would have needed to explain what it means to go one further, because there is no seventh point. So this is why I'm doing it in this way. Basically, I just want to say that I have two points that are next to each other. And if they are mapped in the same way by the symmetry, so if the images under sigma and tau are the same, then I claim that the symmetries are the same. So they map all the points in the same way. So philosophically speaking, this lemma tells us that if we want to understand what a symmetry does, it's enough to understand what it does on two points that are neighbors. And that's quite strong, because it means that we have a way to reduce information. We don't need to tell for all the points where they go. We only need two neighbors. And if we say it there, then everything else follows from that. Let's prove this. And you will have lots of opportunities to use this later today, but also in the exercises. This is a very powerful little lemma. And there is room for the proof. And actually, I can maybe use this picture for illustration a little bit. In my head, I still have my old notation. Sorry, this is 3.1, not 2. Let me check the time. Oh yeah, it's fine. We can go for another half an hour, I think. Yes.
I'm confused about what kind of symmetry we are talking here, because even if we don't take a regular n-bond, it's just a weird shaped polygon, but even if you're moving one vertex, it will also move, the other vertex will also move. So even in
yes.
that case, this is intuitively applicable.
Yes, we have no idea what the symmetry does, because we have not yet classified them. We only know that it's a bijective map and that it's distance preserving, and we are going to use distance preserving in the sense of, if one is fixed, then the two neighbors have to stay, or they have to swap places because of distance. If something is fixed, then the opposite, if there is an opposite, has to be fixed. And if there are two opposite vertices because n is odd, then they have to be fixed or they have to swap places. So distance gives us rules. Otherwise, we have no idea, because we don't know. It could be a reflection, it could be a rotation, it could be something completely wild that we have not seen to this day. We have no idea. And mathematical work means forgetting about the stuff that we don't know, forgetting about the examples we do know mostly, but working at an abstract level. And this is dangerous, because of course we want to have pictures and we want to have intuition, but it's also powerful. It is the power of maths that we can do this context-free. And then later, for all the examples that we see, it will always be applicable. This is actually one of our strengths. So in order to get used to it, we feel like we lose a lot of stuff, because we're not allowed to work in examples all the time, and we have to pretend we don't know anything. But later, this becomes the biggest strength, because everything is so general, and there will be so many places where we can apply it. I hope I'm making sense. A little bit. Okay. Good. Let's go. we have a notation. We have sigma and tau. We have the points I and I plus 1, two points that are neighbors, and they are mapped in the same way. And how are we going to prove that these two symmetries are the same? Well, we have to prove that every point is mapped in the same way. So we have to prove that an arbitrary point is mapped by sigma in the same way that it's mapped by tau. And here comes a trick from group theory. We are going to use the symmetries form group in the following way. Sigma being equal to tau is equivalent to, whoops, so saying that sigma times tau inverse is the identity map. Why is that? Now, I take this equation and I use that we have a group, which means that tau has an inverse map, and then I apply tau inverse on both sides on the right. And if I do that, then on the right-hand side of the equation, they cancel out, I get the identity map. On the left-hand side, I get exactly what I wrote down. So I'm using group theory in order to get another condition that I can try and prove of what to us, which is a little bit different, because now I'm trying to prove that this map here doesn't do anything. So if I apply this to any point, then it will not be moved. So maybe I can do this. And then it will be equivalent to what we're trying to prove. Right, so this for ideas for the proof. Let me check whether I said everything I wanted to say beforehand. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we are going to give this a name. Sorry. Okay, false alarm. Let's give this a name. Let's call it alpha. And for this map, we are going to prove that it's the identity map. Now, next little simplification. Let's look at our sigmon. So the points that I have, I don't know where they are. I only know that they are neighbors, right? Does it matter where they are in our n-gon? Does it matter whether the points are 4 and 5, or maybe 6 and 1, or maybe 3 and 4? Does it matter? No, because of the rotational symmetry. So in order to make our notation easier, I can just say that the two points that I know something about are the points 1 and 2. Right? Without loss. Without loss of generality, and we thought about why this works. Without loss, I is 1 and I plus 1 is 2. Which means that I know that the images of 1 and 2 are the same under sigma and tau. But now I can apply alpha to 1 and 2 and see what happens. What happens if I apply alpha to 1? Well, it gets mapped by sigma first, so I get some point, I have no idea which one it is, and then it gets mapped by tau inverse. But the thing is that sigma and tau map one in the same way. So I can replace this image here by 1 to the tau, by 1 mapped by tau, by hypothesis. So this is because, maybe I should go back to our little color scheme. This here comes from the fact that 1 sigma is 1 tau by hypothesis. And then again, I'm mapped by tau inverse. But tau and tau inverse, they inverse each other. So now I have done nothing and I get 1. And I can do the same for the point 2, and I don't have to repeat the argument, I think, because 2 is I plus 1. So again, I can do the same. Sigma and tau map I plus 1 in the same way. Similarly, 2 to the alpha is 2. You look skeptical. What is it that I should explain again?
No, actually I was thinking about this reflection thing, and you said when we consider rotation that it's super clear to me that we can take either of these points. But if the symmetry represents a reflection, then it matters.
Which one? Which symmetry?
Like this either alpha.
None of them. I didn't say anything about them. I only said that the rotational symmetry of the n-gon tells us that it doesn't matter which two points we take.
Yeah.
I did not say anything about sigma or tau.
Okay.
They are anything.
Okay.
We have no idea what they are.
Okay.
Thank you. Very good point, just in case other people were confused as well. Yes. So I use the rotational symmetry in order to argue that it doesn't matter which two points I take next to each other. I do not say anything about what sigma or tau do. They can be wild. They can be your favorite symmetries. What do we have here now? We have a symmetry that fixes the point 1 and it also fixes the point 2, and we can use this picture in order to try and understand what this means. So now suppose in this picture that you have a symmetry, so a map, please think of maps, and it maps 1 to itself and it also maps 2 to itself. Where can the other points go? Where can they go? I mean, 1 has 2 neighboring points, namely 2 and 6. One of the neighboring points is fixed. So what happens to the other neighboring point? Where can it go?
It also has to be fixed.
It has to be fixed because of distance. So there's no place for number 6 to go. Right, and then we take 2. One of the neighbors is fixed because it's 1, but then the other neighbor has to be fixed as well because there is no place where it can go because of distance. And this way, we just walk around and we see that everything is fixed because of distance preservation. Huh. Okay, let's write this down. Then n, so in our general argument, the other neighbor of 1 is n. Because we go round 1, 2, 3, blah, 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 and at the end we have the point n, that is the other neighbor of 1. Then n to the alpha is n because of the distance preservation. And then we look to 3. 3 to the alpha is like 3, is equal to 3, etc., which means that finally, all points are fixed by alpha, and the only symmetry that does that is the identity map. Which means, looking back, that sigma times tau inverse is the identity map, which means, because of the uniqueness of the inverse, that sigma and tau are the same. So, Maybe you see that we use a mixture of arguments here. So we use this very abstract group theory stuff in the beginning in order to reformulate the problem. Then we do stuff that is a little bit more intuitive. We argue with images and neighbors and distances and stuff. And then in the end, it's just abstract group theory again in order to wrap it up. And this is so powerful because now in so many pictures, you can reduce things to a very tiny space. And if you understand what's happening there, then everything else follows from context. Okay, any questions? Yes?
In this step, you assume sigma equal to tau.
Say it again?
You assumed sigma. We started with sigma equal to tau.
No, we didn't. Mm-mm. This is what we want to prove.
Exactly.
And we say it's equivalent to this statement, and we try to prove this statement. And here, I'm not saying that sigma and tau are the same. I only say that they map 1 in the same way.
This is in our hypothesis.
I and F plus 1 are mapped in the same way, and these have the roads now of 1 and 2, and therefore I can use that 1 and 2 are mapped in the same way. I have no idea about the other numbers, and in particular I'm not using this. But thank you. It's actually, these questions are great, because it means that we can make it even more clearer. So this is what we prove. This is not what we prove, only for 1 and 2. Just as a comment for the proof, so that it becomes more clear maybe what we use and what we don't use. Yeah, and I'm glad that you asked this question, because it's a classic mistake also with my first year students, that they begin with the statement that they want to prove, and then they do some magic, and then they think it's a proof, and no, it's not, usually. Yeah. Okay, are you fine with this argument? Happy with this lemma?
Is there a way to make this argument more formal?
What is it that you want more formal?
That, for example, to prove that another choice for the map, the image of 2 would be, or the image of n would be distance, violated distance preservation.
You can, so what you can always do is you can put more words to what I said. I made this brief because the whiteboard was almost finished, but of course I could be more precise by just using more words and more details. So let me try and do it at least orally. For example, here we say 1 is fixed and 2 is fixed. This was still quite formal, I think. At least nothing intuitive happened here. And then I can say now, because of the structure of the regular n-norm, there are 2 points with equal distance to 1, namely 2 and n. All the other points have a different, all the other vertices have a different distance, which is why a symmetry must preserve the set 2, n. Given that 2 is already fixed, the other point also needs to be fixed for the set to be fixed by the symmetry. And then I move to the next one. So this would be a more formal way of saying that. Right? So I would use the geometry of the regular n-norm, but I would describe it in terms of, given a vertex, there is a unique set of vertices closest to it, except for the vertex itself. So I would call them neighbors, just for us, so that the language is easier. And this set has to be stabilized, and by that I mean that the 2 points in the set can only be fixed each, or they can be interchanged, but nothing else can happen because of distance. And then if you have the set and it's stabilized and one of the elements is stabilized, then the other element has to be stabilized as well, which is the first step. And then, for example, you could do an induction argument and say, if so and so many points are fixed, then we can prove in this way that the next point is also fixed. So there are various ways how you could do this if you wanted to. Is that roughly answering the question?
Yes, I guess if you would be very strict about it or rigorous, you could first start with the definition of an n-norm, what it means, and then the definition of the distance.
Oh yeah, but I'm not doing that here because of the application context. Yeah. Yeah, of course. But this is one of the things that my PhD student does for BEAM, for the graduate research school. So we actually go back to the mathematical foundations when we talk about these tilings and tessellations, and we try to mathematically rigorously capture what these things mean. What is a triangle? What is a tessellation with triangles? What is all this stuff? Yeah, we do that, but not here. Not here. Thank you for asking. Right.
Yes. So n is necessarily finite, right?
Excuse me, say it again.
So n here is necessarily finite.
Of course, n is a natural number, as in our hypothesis, and it's at least 3, and there's no further restriction. So the n-norm can be arbitrarily large, but it has to be regular, which is one of the reasons why we can argue with distances in this way. If you want to generalize this to other shapes, then just use the regularity you still have in order to understand what symmetry means in your context, and then you can maybe find very similar arguments. So I've seen this work in other contexts too, for example with graphs. Should we do a little excursion, 5 minutes on graphs? It's fun. Color, blue. 5 minutes on graphs. Let's say I have a graph, and it looks like this. And I want to understand what an automorphism of this graph does. An automorphism of this graph is, again, a bijective map from the set of vertices to itself, and it has to respect edges. So if there is an edge before, then there is an edge after mapping, and vice versa. No new edges, nothing can be deleted. That would be an automorphism, let's say symmetry for now, because we're used to the word symmetry. Symmetry of the graph would be bijective, and the edges have to be in one correspondence to. So what could we do here? Let's look. Are there any interesting symmetries? I have no idea. There is one vertex here that is special because it has 1, 2, 3, 4 neighbors. There's only one of those.
So a symmetry of the graph has to map this vertex to itself. There is nowhere else it can go, otherwise the number of edges will be violated, right? So this vertex can only go to itself. But, of course, we might be able to swap the neighbors around. For example, these here, these three, they have no further attachment. They can be swapped around. So we have six possibilities in order to keep this where it is, but interchange these three vertices here. So that gives us six symmetries for the graph. Everything else stays, and these three walk around. Okay, let's move on from here. What are the possibilities for the rest? So this vertex has three vertices that have no further attachments, and it has a unique vertex that goes further with more neighbors. So this has to be fixed. If this is fixed, then this has to be fixed. So can you see how it's similar to what we just did? We have something that is fixed, and then we argue why more stuff is fixed. This is always the principle. This is how it works, and this is why I'm showing you this. Now, this here has three neighbors, but they have very different qualities. One of them is the very special neighbor we started with. It's fixed. Then it has one neighbor with no further attachment, and it has one neighbor with more neighbors. So they are distinct from each other. The graph structure forces that if this is fixed, then this is fixed, and then this is fixed. And then we can move on, and everything is fixed, except for here, where these two can swap places, because they don't have anything to do with the rest, which means that we have now classified the group of symmetries of this graph. We have 6 times 2 possibilities, because this here moves independently from this here. This is a group of order 12, and we can describe what the automorphisms of the symmetries do. And it was very easy to do, because we just stared at it, and we found a place where we can start with our argument. That's fun, right? That's part of my research. That's actually fun.
Good. Let's check the time. Let's go another few minutes before we take our first break. Let's look at the next result. Because the next result is a mixture of something that we do here together and an exercise. And for this exercise, I'm asking you to basically use the ideas that we have now developed. And these ideas are, in a nutshell, if we have a regular n-gon, then we can describe what a symmetry does by describing what it does on the vertices, and we can write this as permutation. That's the first principle. The next principle is, if we know what happens on two neighbors, then we know everything. And we have a group. So use this. Use all this information for this exercise. And let's see what the next lemma tells us. So, do you have a question? Yes. What is your question?
It's about the graph.
Yeah, yeah, please ask.
So when you fix the point, and then we have certain points that get interchanged. So then how am I defining my symmetry here?
Yes, thank you. A symmetry of this graph is any map that maps the set of points to itself and the set of edges to itself, but it's allowed to interchange vertices or to interchange edges as long as the graph looks the same afterwards.
Okay.
Which means that, for example, I could have a symmetry that interchanges these two and interchanges these two and leaves the rest alone. Afterwards, the graph would still look the same, but we have changed something. And it could be expressed as a permutation. So if we give numbers to these vertices, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, then I could describe it as the permutation where these two are interchanged and these two are interchanged. So just like over there, we could write it down and everything else would be fixed, and then we know exactly what has happened. Yeah.
So when we define this permutation, because we are now fixing set number of points, do we need to even like consider them?
Yes, we need to consider them in the beginning when we... So it depends on where you want to go. If you want to just have an example of a symmetry, then you can do this, do that, and have a little look and see that everything else can be fixed and it's fine. But then you would just write down one example of a symmetry. What we did before in our little game was we tried to understand all symmetries of the graph. So I started with an arbitrary symmetry and I tried to find a point for first information. But of first, this is quite, I mean, I do this a lot. So I look at it and I immediately see points for first information. In our case here, the point for first information was this one very special vertex that has four neighbors, unlike all the others. And this is why I started there. I could have chosen something else, but my intuition told me that guy tells me what's going on. And it did, right?
Yeah.
It told us everything.
Yeah.
If the graph was different and there was something else like this somewhere over there, then it would have been more difficult and then we would have taken more time maybe, or maybe two or three tries before we find everything out. But yeah, graphs are great. I cannot even begin to tell you how great graphs are. And I wrote several papers with people from computer science where we use graphs in order to design algorithms for really, really hard problems. And we are able to do this because graphs have lots of advantages put together that we do not see in many other objects. So first of all, they're very intuitive, right? I draw some pictures and everyone knows what I'm talking about. They exhibit a lot of symmetry. Depending on the graph, you can have perfect symmetry or almost no symmetry. So you can model lots of stuff. Mm-hmm. And they are really good for computers. That's why the combination of these aspects gives us such powerful tools. Sorry, I'm getting too excited.
But this is really fun. Let's look at the next lemma that we're going to prove. In this next lemma, we have a very precise situation because this time we know exactly what our symmetries do. We have a symmetry that is called S, that is a reflection, and we have a symmetry called D, that is a rotation. You can tell that last time I taught this, it was in German, because it was S for Spiegelung and D for Drehung, those who speak German. And now we prove three properties, and they will help us later when we do calculations with symmetries. Because as we mentioned now several times, there are two types of symmetries that we already know and that we work with a lot, namely rotations and reflections, but we don't know other symmetries that might come our way. Before we did an abstract argument about neighbors, now we do a very precise argument about combinations of reflections and rotations. You can think of them as calculation rules. Just calculation rules. It's nothing more than that. The first rule is that if you have a rotation and you combine it, and I'm using star here because star is my standard notation sign for the composition of maps, but if you prefer, you can just use dots as before in your notation, so please don't be confused by the stars. This is really just me and my obsession with notation that differentiates between different things that are going on. So for me, stars composition of maps. And if we combine a rotation from the left with a reflection and then from the right with the same reflection, which means that we do a composition of three maps in total, reflection, rotation, same reflection, then we actually get the inverse of the rotation we started with. I don't know whether this is intuitive to you or not. I don't know whether you have seen this before or not, but it's worth checking, and it's fun checking with the things we have already learned. So this is why this is an exercise. And now, very similar, rule 2 and 3, and we are only going to prove one of them because the other one is very similar. So if I combine a rotation and a reflection, then what I get is again a reflection, and I can also say what the reflection does, because the axis of the reflection can be obtained from the old one by rotating clockwise or anti-clockwise, depending on what we do, by half the rotation angle. So that's a rule for calculations. Okay? How about we have a little break and then we prove the second statement together. The first one will be your exercise. The third one is clear once we have done the second one, and then we move on from there. Let's take 15 minutes, so you have time to get coffee or tea. The thing here for the coffee machine is here, so please feel free. Maybe think a little about this lemma and the proof, because one of the parts is an exercise. And then we meet again at 10:45.